KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
He loves basketball. Now, I said the same thing I said. Obama loves basketball. Let's start there.
I really regret that we're at this position publicly. I mean, I really have to say that. It's not where I think either of us want to be.
That's one thing if you want to try her for treason, but are you going to just drop a drone Hellfire missile on Jane Fonda?
Some of the voices in the news this week, it was Rand Paul talking, as you heard, about Jane Fonda. Mayor Mike McGinn on Cairo talking about this very public dispute between his office and city attorney Pete Holmes, and Dennis Rodman doing a little basketball diplomacy in North Korea. From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scherr will be back on Monday. It has been a really busy week in the world of news, from the implementation of the sequester to the infighting at Seattle City Hall. And joining us in the studio to talk about this and more, Knut Berger is the Mossback at crosscut.com, editor-at-large for Seattle Magazine, and it's so good to have you here in person.
Oh, thank you. I made it to the studio this week.
Yep. Last week it was because of traffic. But that also evokes many stories while you're sitting in a parking lot. Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger and in for Joni Balter, but as himself, C.R. Douglas, political analyst for Q13 Fox News. Nice to see you.
Good morning.
Well, let's talk national before we winnow down to local. I was interested after 4 years in office, President Obama finally decided that he would break bread with Republicans. And I'm wondering, is this the new approach to politics in Washington, D.C., and will it work? Eli's smiling there.
Who knows if it'll work? I mean, nothing has worked so far in terms of getting them to come to an agreement. But the strategy that Obama seems to be implementing is trying to pick off Republicans from their leadership. You notice he's not meeting with John Boehner anymore. He's meeting with...
Well, he is meeting with Paul Ryan, or did meet with Paul Ryan. Isn't that a leader?
Actually, no.
He's not a leader?
Well, he's not in the official House leadership.
I know how he chose Paul Ryan. How did he choose these guys he was going to take out for dinner?
The senators?
Yeah.
He chose them, I believe, based on math. If he can get them to swing around to some sort of compromise and add them to the Democratic votes that he has in the Senate, then potentially he can get the Senate to agree to a deal, which then puts the House in the position of having to either nix a deal that the public would probably like to see reached or come to some sort of compromise.
He's been watching Lincoln, Steven Spielberg's movie, yes? CR's nodding. What do you think about this? Is this a change in politics as usual?
Well, he didn't have any more cards in his deck. I mean, listen, he won an election convincingly, and that didn't change the dynamic. After the election, he sort of morphed his campaign into this sort of organizing for action group that was then going to go around Congress and sort of drum up public support. That hasn't worked on guns yet. It did not work in the sequester. Listen, the sequester, every single day he was trotting out, you know, different sort of parts of the government that would be disastrously hit, and that didn't move anything in terms of the needle in Washington. So the sort of rally public support and have them call your congressman didn't work. The election didn't work. So now it is about sort of going, as Eli says, and picking off not the leadership, because that hasn't worked either, but picking off some sort of, you know, possible moderate Republicans. And to answer your question, how did this sort of list get sort of created? Well, I think he went to Lindsey Graham, as I understand it, and said, Lindsey, let's, you know, bring 12 people to me. So I think it was actually Lindsey Graham.
Chose these people.
Yeah, with the condition that it not be a leader. You mentioned Lincoln, and I actually think that is kind of important here. I mean, the sort of lesson of Lincoln was that to get the 13th Amendment passed, you know, which was ending slavery, Lincoln did not pass out the Gettysburg Address and copies of the Emancipation Proclamation. He passed out jobs to districts and states to get votes. And what I think this is showing is that Obama needs to basically kind of do that. He needs to sort of go straight to some of these representatives, straight to some of these senators, and say, hey, what do you need? What is it going to take?
Is this because this sounds like a last ditch effort for the president? So is this so distasteful to him to play politics this way, Knut?
Well, he certainly has a reputation for being aloof in Washington, D.C. terms. He's no LBJ. I mean, you know, Lyndon Johnson was a guy who was, you know, pressed the flesh, was willing to twist arms, break arms if necessary. But LBJ had some advantages that Obama doesn't. One of those advantages, of course, was a lot more experience in Congress. The other advantage or one of the other advantages was he had money to give away. I mean, he could buy votes that he needed. You could earmark, you could horse trade. The Lincoln movie, of course, talks about, you know, giving away, you know, getting a vote in exchange for, you know, what, being named postmaster of the Oregon Territory or mm-hmm. something. I mean, it was a there were goodies to hand out and outright bribes.
Yes.
which was much more the custom in some ways more blatant than now. So. In an era where you're talking about cost cutting, budget cutting, you're talking about fiscal restraint, where earmarks have been exposed or been banned, it's a lot harder to do that kind of nitty gritty, ugly political deal making than it was back in the day.
That doesn't really stop people, does it?
Well, I was going to say Obama did pick up the tab for dinner. That's probably enough of a payoff, but he paid for that out of his own pocket.
Out of his salary.
He put it on his credit card, right? His personal. Yeah, I don't think
The government is not paying for it.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, since the whole notion of the sequester is that we're just hacking away. I don't know how much hacking has started yet.
Well, that's what I was going to point to in terms of the question about whether this is the last ditch effort or the last card he has to play. I don't think it is. I think that as the sequester cuts start to take effect, you will begin to see more of a public outcry. The problem is that's going to be very, very slow, and you can't exactly predict when the public outcry will reach a critical mass. And so right now, the only card Obama has to play is dinners.
Am I correct that right now the government is funded through the end of May, March? Through the end of this month, the continuance was just through the end of the month. So
Right. What
has to happen to get this government? It seems like this is how federal government's been operating for years, that, you know, we go right up to a deadline and then we decide, OK, we're going to pass this bill, but it's just temporary. And everybody gets paid for another 60 days. And this is, in this case, 30 days. And then we go on. It's nutty.
Well, part of the problem here is that these things have been separated out, and they're doing them individually. So the fiscal cliff was sort of one fight. The sequester was another fight. This continuing resolution is going to be another fight. We got a debt ceiling, you know, fight coming up. The problem is when you do them one at a time, they get very polarized. So the fiscal cliff was very polarized between, you know, Democrats who wanted to increase those tax rates and Republicans who didn't. The sequester was sort of the reverse. I mean, you have sort of basically Republicans that were, you know, on the side of letting the sequester happen and Democrats on the side of not having them. The advantage of putting these all together in a grand bargain, which they have not been able to do yet, is that you have everyone in the game. You're never going to solve this thing unless everyone sort of agrees to give a little bit. And it's very hard to give a little bit when you have these individual showdown fights that are very polarizing. A grand bargain works when everyone gets up and you don't have unanimity or this huge support because everyone is suddenly this breakout of agreement. It's basically a sense that everyone feels like someone else is hurting the deal too. I'm voting for someone, but the other guy's got some pain. They're not all in agreement. They are approaching the deal for very different reasons. They get different things out of it, but they have a sense that the other guy's getting pain in the process.
Well, that's
and that is not something they've been able to do yet.
Well, that's deal making. I mean, isn't that the whole
it's
notion
deal making,
of compromise?
The problem is by piecing these. Yeah. Different things out, they can't get to that situation where they're all sort of in the room agreeing that they like some of it and don't like others, and they can all vote for it.
Boy, we sure haven't seen that in years. We're talking over the week's news with C.R. Douglas, Eli Sanders, Knute Berger, and we'll open the phones. You can weigh in as well, 206-543-5869, 206-543-KUOW, or you can email us weekday@KUOW.org. We have to wait till those lines actually get opened, so don't call quite yet. Let's go from the cosmic unknown of the federal budget to what's been happening in the city of Seattle, because we heard a little cut of Mike McGinn on Cairo, and this whole Pete Holmes, Mike McGinn tiff, kerfuffle, fight, power struggle, however you want to characterize it, has been most interesting because it seems so atypical of Seattle's politics as usual. This seems more like Chicago or someplace. We don't really see this.
Well, and also interesting because it reveals something that we kind of suspect about at least one of these characters. McGinn early on got a reputation as a bulldog, a guy who likes a fight, a lawyer who will fight over every last detail until he gets his way. And he very quickly learned that that was not the most useful way to present himself. And so we haven't seen that McGinn for a long time. Particularly, we haven't seen it during his run-up to the mayoral race. But somehow, Pete Holmes got under his skin with this standoff over who has more authority to negotiate with the feds over police reform. And I actually, CR will have to explain more exactly what the particulars of their technical disagreement is. I think their dispositional disagreement is I don't think it's a dispositional disagreement. I think it's a collision of two guys with similar dispositions who both think they're the boss of the other, and this is a hard thing to resolve.
You're not the boss of me. Before we have CR actually explain it to us because he probably totally understands.
Because he knows.
Because he knows how it all works. Knute, have you been watching what's been happening at City Hall?
How can't you?
Yeah, I have. And I think Eli is right. The mayor and the city attorney have butted heads before. And the city attorney has, as Eli said, some of the same reputation that the mayor has. And they're both kind of knee-jerk litigators. And that has, been a criticism, particularly of McGinn, since he's a lawyer, but being mayor is not, you're not the city's attorney.
Yeah, and Pete Holmes, that's his job.
You have somebody for that. But it's interesting, and it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see if what kind of challenge, if any, Holmes attracts. As a result of
is he up for re-election in the fall too? All right, so CR, explain the legalities of this, if you would.
Well, at bottom, what this is a question about what Pete Holmes' role as a city attorney. So the charter of the city sort of gives him the power to sort of oversee and lead on litigation. So the question here is this whole consent decree and this whole sort of relationship with the monitor and the federal government litigation? And technically it is.
Really?
Yes. It's sort of a court case. So Pete's point is, listen, this is litigation. I'm actually the one in charge of overseeing this. And the mayor is saying, yes, but you're also my lawyer, and I have a role here. You know, at the end of the day, I'm the guy that's running this city. I'm the guy that sort of, drives policy. I'm the guy that has to be responsible for this. So it's a fight over who is the lead on this. And there has been, I think the mayor can make, somewhat of a case that Pete has gone around him a bit in negotiation with the DOJ. And sort of did that breach attorney-client privilege, all the rest. I mean, it's a complicated thing, and I think at the end the public won't probably get the legal fight, but what they will get is that there is a spat going on. I think this is a disaster for the mayor. I think it sort of plays up, as Eli said, sort of, his less desirable side, and it interrupts the sort of narrative he has been carefully crafting since the low point in his administration, which was losing that viaduct tunnel fight a couple years ago. And since then, he has been trying to sort of look like he's a guy that can get along, build coalitions, and all the rest. And this is just a big step back in that narrative.
We're going to talk more about the mayor, the mayoral race, city council, and drones. And you can call us as well at 206-543-5869. Friday, talking over the week's news here on Weekday on KUOW.
With all the discussion these days of more gun regulations, what do we really know about how or whether existing regulations prevent gun violence? We're going to take that up today at noon on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Soaring Heart Natural Bed Company. For more than 30 years, handcrafting mattresses and pillows. This month, featuring all-organic, custom-designed pillow toppers for the bed. More information and sleep resources are available by visiting their Fremont workshop or at SoaringHeart.com.
44 degrees in Seattle. The sky is clearing. Should give us plenty of sun this afternoon with a predicted high of 52. Overnight, stars and a low of 38, and tomorrow, Saturday, mostly sunny again with a high of 53. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 1020.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scher, and we're talking over the week's news with C.R. Douglas, Eli Sanders, Knute Berger, and you at 206-543-5869. And during that little break there, C.R., you and I were talking about something that I guess yesterday said we had Connie Rice in here, who's a noted civil rights attorney who's been involved in the Los Angeles Police Department and County Sheriff's Department consent decree implementation for the past 14 years. That's how long they've been working on it. And something that she said to me is that there is no wiggle room. And you were saying, in fact, you think that there is some wiggle room in the scope of the monitor's plan, Monitor Merrick Bobb, and he submitted the plan on Tuesday.
It is. I mean, part of the fight here is about sort of, you know, what the lawyer's role is and who's the lead on that. But there is a policy dispute here, and this is really the fundamental problem between McGinn and Holmes. Holmes basically got his career started. It was launched by being an advocate for police reform. He was the first member of the sort of police oversight committee. He's been a staunch reformer. He wants as much reform as you can possibly get in this department. That is not sort of, he's not silent on that, you know? The mayor, on the other hand, is wanting reform, but he's also not wanting to sort of hamstring the city budget and sort of, you know, he doesn't want to sort of alienate his own police department. So he's got a role and got a position of not wanting the scope of reform to be so large, so sort of, you know, unmanageable. So it's a fight over how much reform the city is going to allow. And this monitor plan is a pretty aggressive reform plan. And the mayor kind of wants to narrow that. Pete wants to keep it broad. That's really what's going on here.
In the middle of it this week, the several members of the city council talked about a measure that would further perhaps limit police department surveillance. I think the slog put it so brilliantly. I can't remember the headline, Eli. Can you remember how you guys characterized this?
No. Something
like the mayor.
Well, it was the mayor's secret spy cam network.
Thank you for remembering that.
Triumph alliteration.
Yeah, it made it sound as if, you know, Mike McGinn himself is setting up surveillance cameras and putting those drones aloft.
But the point was, and I think this was Dominic, if I remember right, who made this point, that these things occurred under his watch, whether it was his plan to get the drones going or not, whether it was his plan to get the cameras along Alki or in West Seattle going or not, those plans both popped up from under the radar at the last minute on his watch. And so you can make an argument in the city council that we need a different process here. And
that's what the bill is. It's essentially
exactly
that the police department or whoever wants to put surveillance equipment someplace needs to make that public.
Well, they need to talk to the city council. Yeah. I mean, if they want to buy the stuff, you know, they have to get approval for that. We talked a little bit about the issue last week, and one of the problems with drones being the sort of militarization of police departments. And one thing that's happened since we last talked about this is the ACLU, the Our state ACLU is joining a national ACLU. I think 24 states in all are doing an investigation of the militarization of police departments. And one of the things is just to gather data on drone use, weaponry, tactics, funding sources, all the things that and I think this is one of the issues. It's funny because you're talking about police reform. You're talking about a police department that has been accused of having a propensity toward violence and injustice toward different communities. At the same time, police departments all over the country, including this one, have been arming up in ways that it's sort of the trickle down from the wars that we've been waging.
That's a good verb,
yeah,
too.
And the technologies. And I think it's great that there's going to be kind of a national effort just to look at the phenomenon.
Eli?
One part of this look is the fact that this all traces back to the Department of Homeland Security. The drone program in Seattle was funded by a Homeland Security grant. And so there's a sense in which a lot of these phenomena that are bothering people, police departments, you know, showing up with drones that they want to use, are nudged along not by mayors or by local police chiefs, but by money that is pushed out there by the federal government through the Homeland Security Department to test these programs.
We're talking over the week's news with our panel of guests, Eli Sanders, Knute Berger, C.R. Douglas here. And we have a listener who wants to go back to talk about Seattle Police Department, TIFF. So let's go to Lamont on Queen Anne. Hi, thanks for holding.
Hi. I want to talk about the fight between the city lawyer and the mayor and not understanding how this could look bad on the mayor. Whenever anyone hires a lawyer, we hire them to represent us in our position. The lawyer doesn't want to represent us in our position. They don't take the case. So I'm not sure how come Holmes, who is hired to represent the city and directly get that representation through the mayor, he could be an advocate for any choice he wants. But when he's a hired lawyer, he does what his client says, not what he feels. Now, I feel like if he wants to reform the police force or whatever in the way that he wants, he should run for elected official and see if the people of Seattle want the same reforms that he wants in the manner he wants, and then he can push those reforms. But he's a paid lawyer told what to do.
Well,
if he doesn't want to do that, he should quit his job or not take that case.
Well, he is actually – thanks for that call. He is actually elected, Lamont. He was elected citywide, wasn't he?
He was. And that's one of the – problems for Pete Holmes here, I think, actually. This does look bad for the mayor because it plays to some of the traits that people have seemed not to like about him. But for Pete Holmes, I think the commonsensical understanding of an attorney is that he works for someone. The fact is he was elected and he has room to make his own choices, but this is like the standoff between Governor Gregoire and Rob McKenna over the health care lawsuit, where McKenna went rogue, basically, and used the fact that he was independently elected to justify himself making decisions that were at odds with his boss. For the average person, I think that looks bad, as Lamont's pointing out.
Knute?
Yeah, I agree. It looks bad. It looks like, the city can't get its act together. And ultimately, and as McGinn acknowledged, you know, this makes me look bad.
Well, it does.
So he has a political concern. But it's also fair to say that the city attorney, being an elective office, just like attorney general, is that these positions get highly politicized. And they are often occupied by people with big political ambitions. Mark Sidran, Doug Jewett. We have had, political people who've run for mayor, who were city attorney and who fight over these issues. So it's also not a neutral battleground.
Okay. I don't know what Pete Holmes' political ambitions are. Do you, CR?
Well, he certainly had been talked about as a contender for McGinn. You know, as a possible guy jumping in that race. He's chosen not to, but I think Knute's absolutely right. I mean, this is a position that has launched a lot of people, and I don't think anyone would say that Pete Holmes doesn't have ambition.
And this is all speculation, but if you're Pete Holmes and you're looking at the mayor's race, and you're asking yourself, who would I rather work with for the next 4 years? Probably the answer for Pete Holmes is not Mike McGinn. And so if this reflects badly on both of them, but worse on McGinn, it might be worth it for Holmes to get under McGinn's skin here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if I'm a contender for the mayor's race, you know, if I'm Peter Steinberg or Tim Burgess or these people that are in, I feel like they should be declaring an in-kind contribution from Pete Holmes right now.
Exactly.
I mean, he is doing a wonderful job from their perspective at bringing the mayor down. I mean, this fight is not going to hurt Pete Holmes. Pete Holmes has no challenger right now, and won't, I suspect, have any challenger of note. But this is bringing them probably both down, but the relevant person that has to worry is the mayor.
Well,
and he's already saying, I regret this, and he's trying to get out of this fight, but it's damage done.
Well, let's talk about that, because King 5 released the results of a poll, and the mayor was tied with somebody who hasn't even declared for office, Ron Sims, and these two were not very far ahead of, was it Peter Steinbrück the next closest, or Tim Burgess?
Tim
Burgess. So I believe it was 19% the mayor was polling, and 17 for Tim Burgess, and 15 for Peter Steinbrück. I mean, it didn't look all that great.
No, these are bad numbers. I mean, if you look at the same time 4 years ago, Greg Nickels, who lost in the primary, was polling at like 25%. So McGinn is at 15% with Ron in the race, 18%, I guess 19% if Ron Sims is not in the race. But, you know, anything under 20 at this point is a tough, tough road for McGinn.
Although the difference between this race and 4 years ago is the number of ways the pie is divided up.
Right.
We have so many people in the race, and even this phantom candidate, Ron Sims, who is such a strong draw in a lot of people's minds that people are putting him in polls even when he's not declared, which is odd. I think it was strange to put an undeclared candidate in the King 5 poll.
Yeah, well, it was interesting to see the difference, because Sims and McGinn were tied 15-15 if Sims runs, with a large chunk of undecided, I think 34%, something, a big chunk of undecided. If Sims doesn't run, then McGinn is leading the race undecided, and then you have Burgess and Steinbrück, you know, kind of coming up behind. And one of the things it confirms, which has been suspected for a long while, is that, first of all, we don't know if Sims is going to get in. You keep hearing rumors, oh, he's about to decide. He might say something within the next week or two. And this has been going on for, you know,
months.
Since last year. So,
right.
We don't know. But the thing the poll does confirms is that if Ron Sims gets in the race, he's a game changer. The race looks significantly different.
Jason emailed me, our producer Jason. So if Sims is in the race, 15% for him and Mike McGinn, 10% for Burgess, 9% for Ed Murray, 7% for Peter Steinbrück, 5% for Harrell, 1% for Charlie Stedeker and David Ishii polling at 0. If Sims doesn't run, it's 19% for McGinn, 11% for Burgess, and 10 for Steinbrück. And Murray only at 8%. So really, it doesn't look good for Ed Murray.
That was one of the most surprising findings in the poll for me, that Murray was doing relatively poorly compared to other people who you would have thought would end up behind him.
The best thing that could happen for McGinn right now is that Ron Sims does get in the race. We have 5 months until the primary. That is not enough time for McGinn to change the dynamic of his mayoralship. The only thing that allows time for is for the race to change. And the only way I believe McGinn has a chance to get through this primary at a sort of 15, 18, 19% rate right now, where undecideds are not likely going to go to him, they're going to go to these others, is to split the pie up more. He needs Ron Sims to get in to help split that pie. And the minute Ron Sims gets in, then all these other folks, Peter Steinbrück, Tim Burgess, all the rest, they're going to start directing fire at him. And Ron's, you know, going to start taking heat for, you know, problems with the county when he was there and all that kind of stuff. It'll take the focus off McGinn and the fire off McGinn a bit. They'll bring Ron down. perhaps low enough to he wouldn't get through the primary. My guess is they bring Ron down and sort of, you know, Ron and Mike get through the primary and then sort of, you know, a new dynamic.
We're not going to ask you to put money on that, CR, but, you know, that's an interesting scenario because right now it's 34% undecided if Ron Sims is in that race.
Well, it's a significant number.
Yeah.
You could say the good news was for McGinn was he was tied with Ron Sims. the bad news is the number is terrible. 18%. With such a large undecided, it'll shape. It's hard for me to believe, and you can see it in the numbers. Steinbrück and Burgess can gain significantly with a certain dynamics. There's a way in which I don't think the public is completely engaged with the campaign yet. It's still early from the standpoint of the people who are going to be voting in that primary. People haven't really tuned into the specifics, and there haven't been lots of candidate forums. We haven't seen debates, and that will begin to crystallize a lot of stuff.
It'll crystallize, but it's definitely fascinating that we have so many candidates in this race, because 4 years ago we ended up with two people that not a lot of had very little widespread fame, if that's the right word I'm grasping for right here. We have a whole slate of people that a lot of people have heard of that are very seasoned politicians.
And just quickly, what Eli points out is right. I mean, in 2009, you kind of had three major candidates that were sort of getting the vote. And really, if you go back to 2001, you know, you had kind of three major candidates, sort of Nichols, Schell, and Sidran back then coming out of the primary, you know, that got three strong votes in the primary. So it spread wider this time with sort of five major candidates. If Ron's in six, people are talking about Mahmoud Dodon from the chamber is sort of seven. At this point, McGinn needs more, not fewer. That is his only hope, I believe.
And I think there have been races before where there were a ton of really good candidates. Royer's first race in the Ullman's race in the late 60s, where there were a lot of really experienced people, both from city council or from the state legislature. In fact, the one in the 60s, they called it the 10 Little Indians. It was like an Agatha Christie. This one's going to need a name when we get the, you know, it's going to be the, you know, the.
I like that.
And so there have been these things, and it seems to always come down to three slugging it out, and then maybe one who drains votes off of somebody for a specialty, like an Law and Order candidate or a specialty candidate who drains some important votes off.
I like that idea of a specialty candidate. Eli?
On the scenario that CR was painting, that it's good for McGinn if Ron Sims gets in, if in fact McGinn is hoping for that, I think he may be waiting a long time. The problem is that there is zero incentive, as far as I see, for Sims to get in the race now. Not being in the race, he's already being included in the polls.
No kidding.
And he's tied with the mayor. So this kind of wait and see,
without spending a dime,
exactly, is perfect for him. And based on the polling, he could jump in and, without having raised any money, get through the primary at the last minute.
Yeah. Well, the filing deadline is, what, the end of May?
Right.
Oh, so we've got months. So we could have 10 more candidates. We could have
a long time before you really have to make up your mind.
And he's the one person that could get in day of filing and still be competitive.
Yes.
Right, because everybody knows who he is. Yeah. C.R. Douglas, Knute Berger, Eli Sanders here with us talking over the news. Our phone number, 206-543-5869, or email us weekday at kuow.org.
Talking over the news of the week is what we do every Friday morning during the 10 o'clock hour. And of course, every day, KUOW brings you news and information that reflects our world and keeps you connected. But we can't do it without you. It's your financial support that makes it all possible. You may have recently received an appeal in the mail. Please mail in your gift today or give online at kuow.org. Your support right now will help keep our upcoming spring membership drive on target, and we can get you back to regular programming that much sooner. Thanks for your generosity. ...45 degrees in Seattle, looking at a high today of 52. The morning clouds and fog are going away, and it's going to be mostly sunny this afternoon. Patients at Western State Hospital have organized to push back against some safety measures, including a ban on hot coffee. More about that later today during the noon hour.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting comedian and actor Nick Offerman, who plays Ron Swanson on NBC's sitcom Parks and Recreation, live at the Moor on March 21st. Tickets available now at stgpresents.org.
This is KUOW, and I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scher. It is Friday, and as always, we talk about the week's news, a lot of stuff happening, and our guests, C.R. Douglas, Eli Sanders, and Knute Berger, are here to talk about it with you. And, C.R., you took a little trip this week with Governor Inslee. You went to Hanford.
I was at Hanford. He took that trip because six tanks were recently discovered to be leaking radioactive sludge into the groundwater. He's understandably concerned. The federal government is in charge of the whole cleanup effort there at Hanford, and he wants to hold their feet to the fire. So he was touring it with representatives from the Department of Energy, and he claims he has a zero tolerance policy. He's gonna go to court if necessary to make sure DOE cleans up that leak.
Well, I spoke with our Richland correspondent Anna King earlier this week, and she said that most of the reporters, in fact, all the reporters, didn't get to traipse through the field where the waste storage tanks are, did you?
we saw you had a lovely rosy glow about you.
No, I mean, the actual leaking tanks, we drove within, you know, I would say 100 feet of them. We couldn't get off the bus. They are.
Did you want to get off the bus?
I think we were all fine not getting off the bus. They're covered with asphalt. One thing they have done, it's sort of like a big tennis court over the tank farms. That helps prevent some of the rainwater going down and seeping in and sort of aggravating the leaks. So you could see that very clearly. The tanks are, what, 10, 12 feet underground, something like that. We did get close to another tank farm, not too far from that. Those happen to not be leaking, but they're not taking people directly to the leaks, but close.
So what did you get besides the zero tolerance policy from the governor? Because in fact, the sequester will affect what's going on at Hanford.
Yeah, some calculations are $100 million, some calculations are $200 million in cleanup. Sort of money will be not there because of the sequester. The thing that hits home to you very quickly at Hanford is how slow this process is. These leaks are discovered, and it will be 2, probably 4 years before they even get to them. Never mind the sort of larger waste. You know, there's a bunch of waste there that's not leaking, but that needs to be glassified
and that plant's
somewhere.
Not done.
That plant is not done. It was supposed to be online in 2001. It will not be online until 2019.
If everything
Let me remind
okay.
you, supposed to be 2001, now 2019, probably won't be until the early 20s, 2020. So it is a century-long cleanup effort in some ways.
And this kind of reminds me of the leaking pontoons at 520, only that we have these projects that just seem to, that they're both leaking. It's not the leaking part. It's that we take on these gigantic projects.
520 pontoons, as far as we know so far, are not filled with radioactive waste. But who knows?
But they could be storage tanks, you know. They're
empty.
That's
the good news of the week for WatchDot.
but seriously, I mean, these projects are so unbelievably expensive. They take forever. I know that the feds are not in charge of 520 yet. Are they?
No.
No.
There may be a consent decree.
I-90, they have a role. But, it's an interesting point that you're raising, because I read somewhere that the tanks were designed to they had a 20-year lifespan. It's like you're putting 10,000-year waste into 20-year lifespan.
And that's been up probably 2000.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
One
of the things is, particularly when you're dealing with radioactive waste, our political system and our budgets do not reflect the true cost of dealing with this stuff over a 10,000-year lifespan. And we don't have a environmentally sensitive dictator you know, who is going to say we're going to spend, you know, every penny this government generates to make sure that stuff doesn't get into the Columbia River or something. And nobody wants it. Nobody wants this stuff. I mean, we have it because it got put there in secret during World War II, and we, you know, we didn't vote on it. An industry, and they thought they were putting it in a place that wouldn't bother anybody because it was so far from people and that kind of thing. And that hasn't proved to be the case. And so you have this major energy. It's a major industry in the state is just coping with that waste.
Well, oddly, when you say industry, 4,000 people are going to lose their jobs in the Tri-Cities because of the sequester. 4,000 people working on cleanup at Hanford. And the DOE's solution was at some point we're going to send it to New Mexico.
Yeah. New Mexico is sort of the Yucca Mountain of low-level waste. Yucca is where the highest, worst waste was supposed to go, may still if they...
Wait, so this is the low-level waste that's leaking?
So there's several gradations of waste at Hanford, and the leakage is mostly in the lower-level waste. And so that way, I mean, contaminated soil, not the actual plutonium, or, you know, it's sort of the contaminated soil that was sort of mixed up around there, that kind of stuff.
It's still not good.
No. So the idea is to sort of solidify that and grout. Again, this take 2 to 4 years at least, and sort of send that to New Mexico. New Mexico has been accepting from around the country sort of low-level waste in this sort of half-mile below-the-ground salt cavern.
I can't.
Not with pleasure, but they've been doing it. And so their fight here is whether this waste at Hanford is sort of the same low level they've been accepting or not. And the sort of quick early fight we heard from New Mexico is, wait a second, that Hanford waste is higher waste level than we're used to.
Yeah, and they get to decide. They have to allow it. I don't think the DOE, I don't think it works like the consent agreement. I think they get to decide.
Well, it's a little bit complicated. I mean, the federal government ultimately can do what it wants to do, I think, with waste. But yes, there's sort of a tri-party agreement, if you will, and sort of, you know, New Mexico has some role in this. But the feds ultimately control where waste goes.
And as we've seen, this immediately gets caught up in presidential politics. New Mexico being a state that people want to win as part of the Electoral College math. And so you don't want to be, well, in this administration, it's different since this is Obama's second term. But you don't want to be associated with moving nuclear waste to a state that you want to win.
Which is exactly why Yucca Mountain got taken off the table.
Hmm.
I mean, it was a favor to Harry Reid.
As a result, we apply 5- and 10-year solutions to a 10,000-year problem. And now with the 520 situation is somewhat different because, and I'm sure they're relieved that it's not as bad as as Hanford. It's only a $100 million mistake on 520, but they have the contingency funds to
that's a whole other question.
But I think there's a really interesting intersection here, I guess literally an intersection, in the sense that transportation, especially highways, used to be the place where you got political consensus. Everybody, Rob McKenna and Jay Inslee, both said, we want to do a transportation bill. And we might have, the taxes might have to be raised, but we'll go to a vote of the people. Now you're getting a lot of criticism because of some of these foibles with Columbia Crossing, 520 Bridge, the new ferries. You're getting this thing where you have Democrats who are skeptical of highway projects, but you also have Republicans who are now saying, why are we paying so much per mile for everything we build? We're building, it's more expensive to build in Washington. Why is that? And so these cost issues are coming up, and that's then getting underscored by polling that shows that Washingtonians are very resistant to paying any more for road stuff. They think the roads are okay, according to the polls. They don't think there's a problem, and they don't want a gas tax or a car tab fees to go up.
Well, I'm not sure I want the gas tax to go up either. I'd have to see a proposal, but you can't really say that the roads are in good shape.
Well, Knut's right. That recent Elway poll showed that there isn't this sort of, you know, intense frustration about the road conditions. The Democrats unveiled a $10 billion roads package a couple weeks back, which was sort of heavily reliant on the gas tax increase and the car tax increase for a bunch of projects. And I think it's pretty clear that's dead in arrival. I think there just isn't enough support, certainly in the public, based on these polling. I mean, like 60% and 70% against gas tax.
The new Elway poll showed 72% of the people were opposed to a gas tax increase. 62% were opposed to tabs. And, of course, the bike community went nuts over a $25 bike fee. Nobody wants to pay. Now, of course, tolling and other things are still, you know, still in the mix. But in terms of going out now or in the immediate future for some big tax increase to pay for, and I think that the boondoggle element just underscores people's skepticism about do we really? And the fact is, we the taxpayers, particularly those of us in the Puget Sound area, are already paying a ton of money for billions of dollars in transportation projects. I mean,
we are,
you know, with rail and the tunnel and all these other things. It's not like we don't have a lot on the table already.
The only sliver of hope that Democrats have on this, the Democrats who proposed this anyway, is that the Elway poll did not list out what projects specifically would benefit from this money. And when you do that, rather than just talking about $10 billion in new taxes, which, of course, people are not going to be in favor of, you start to get a different result. I don't know if you overcome 60-70% opposition, but when you tell people that something will change in their neighborhood as a result of this, they sometimes come around.
I think that might be the only hope. I mean, I think it's never going to be $10 billion. I mean, it's going to need to be scaled down. It can't rely on both gas and car tab tax. That's just too much of a fight. So maybe a gas tax of sort of not 10 cents, but 3 cents. You know, the public did support, you know, we had a 9.5 gas tax raise in 2005. It was then put on the ballot, you know, approved by legislators and then sort of, you know, referendumed, if you will, and it was approved. And largely because the campaign did an effective job at showing what 9 cents buys in every single county in the state, every single city in the state. So I don't think it's absolutely unheard of that a smaller gas tax only increase with clear project lists could pass voters this fall, but it would take a big campaign.
Well, the campaign is the point. The public often doesn't get important stuff in generalizations. And I'm going back to a Puget Sound partnership did a survey. This is like 3, 4, 5 years ago. They did a survey and they were trying to take people's temperature on whether they were concerned about the health of Puget Sound. Most people think Puget Sound is just tip-top health. Most people, when they do the surveys, I mean, I think it's like 70-80% people say it's just great. Because when you look out your window, it's blue and there are boats and maybe a whale. I mean, people think it's good. And but one of the funny things in that survey was they asked the question, they said they wanted to see kind of where it was in people's consciousness. And they said, name the most important body of water in the Puget Sound region. Hint, hint. And Puget Sound was like way down the list. Most people said Lake Washington or, you know, Haller Lake. I mean, they
really?
Like what the body of water that was kind of right there. And you know, what that told them was that there was this kind of lack of general consciousness. But you can change the general consciousness if, like CR and Eli have said, you know, if you have a specific plan and you go out and you sell it and it's a reasonable, rational plan. It's not hopeless. I don't think people should look at those numbers and think it's hopeless. But in the short term, I mean, it takes time to get through to people.
And if everyone gets a nice parting gift,
something in my backyard,
right,
as opposed to not in my backyard, something for my backyard. David in Northgate, you have a question or a comment?
Oh, wow! I'm on the air. This is great.
You are.
I was under the impression that the state couldn't toll a federal road, and the interstates like 405 and I-90. You know, can they toll those?
Can they?
The answer is yes. They can't do it as easily as they can a state route. You know, state route 520. They own it. They can toll it, no problem. There are hoops you have to go through and agreements you have to get from the federal government. You obviously can't do that without them. But it is not out of the question, and I think with I-90 it's going to happen.
Yeah, and I think the feds have also signaled that they are pro-toll or that tolling options are fine.
But there are going to be any number of legal challenges to putting a toll on I-90. I think that people are already organized in opposition.
And political challenges. I mean, there will likely be something on the ballot if they get their way. You know, the anti-tolling I-90 folks.
Well, it was something to watch. I want to, just as we have just a few minutes left, talk about a story that our own KUOW reporter Ann Dornfeld broke about the Department of Education investigating Seattle Public Schools for essentially racist discipline policies. This is, as I understand it from Ann, the DOE, not energy, but education, is going around the country looking at school districts and obviously starting with urban districts to see if there's disparity in the way they treat kids of color as opposed to Caucasian kids. And I think this is something that parents in the district have been talking about for as long as I've been following education stories.
And that the district seems a little surprised about, not surprised in the sense that they didn't know this was going on. It sounds like this has been going on without people knowing and without even many people in the district knowing for quite some time, and that the district was cooperating. And when they saw the numbers that prove these disparities, they were ready to act. But somehow, until they had this federal intervention and saw these numbers, they weren't.
Something about the data-driven educational system?
And just to be clear what this is, you know, the sort of assumption here based on these numbers is that African-American students, but also just other students of color, are getting disciplined harsher for the same crime, if you will.
And more frequently.
More frequently and longer sentences, longer expulsions, if you will. You know, it has probably gone on here a while. I think even in the early 2000s, there was some reference to it at Seattle schools. It's not unique to Seattle schools.
Right.
I mean, what's happening is that the Department of Education is getting energized about this and looking at districts all over the country. And I think it, you know, it's something many urban districts are going to have to deal with.
But one thing that was interesting to me in talking with Ann a couple of days ago is that we've got these numbers, but the punishment, which is usually suspension or expulsion, you know, there's rectifying unfair punishment, but there's also trying to figure out, do you really want to, like, keep kids from education as a matter of punishment? That is one of the really big issues that it raised, the pathway to prison, people call it.
Right. Well, that's one of the most compelling critiques that I read about this, that suspending a troublesome kid, as you're saying, keeps that person from getting an education, then also leaves that person with a lot of time potentially to commit some petty crime that gets them into, or non-petty crime that gets them into the criminal justice system, which keeps them, again, away from education.
But it seems like money is, or lack thereof, is, as always with education, one of the big problems.
Absolutely. It's easier for a harried teacher or principal to suspend a student than take the time to deal with that student when their time is divided so many ways because there aren't enough teachers and not enough resources in our public schools.
And I suspect this is a factor in the achievement gap. I mean, you know, white students consistently outperform, you know, minority and African-American students. And if you sort of overlay the fact that sort of minority students are getting a raw deal, if you will, on sort of discipline and are out of school more often, I mean, any day out of school is not going to help a student who is struggling. And so this achievement gap, I believe, is probably certainly related to this.
And finally, I just have to talk about state lawmakers and bicyclists and pollution. And Eli, as a bicyclist, I was I'm sure that you feel incredible guilt about every breath you take adding to the smog layer in Seattle.
Right. What was the name of the representative?
Oh, I have to
Orcutt.
Look at it.
Ed Orcutt.
Republican Representative Ed Orcutt said that cyclists in Washington state should willingly pay this $25 tax on any bike purchased above $500 because as they're, you know, biking and doing an aerobic exercise, they are exhaling more, which is contributing to our carbon dioxide problem and global warming and so on.
He apologized.
He did apologize.
I'm not sure if he apologized. I'm not sure if he recanted. Those are different.
He seemed more apologetic about having upset people than the and making himself.
By the same logic, you could accuse Representative Orcutt and all the representatives in Olympia of contributing vastly to our carbon problem without any benefit to their cardiovascular.
I think we're producing a lot of greenhouse gas.
Yes, right here. Hot air from our guests, Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, C.R. Douglas, political analyst for Q13 Fox, Knute Berger's The Mossback at crosscut.com. Latest book is Space Needle, The Spirit of Seattle. Thanks, all of you, for being here.
Thank you.
Our show, produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Alsadi, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette is the engineer. Danielle Anthony Goodwin is the intern. I'm Marcy Silman. I've been in for Steve Scherr. But he's going to be back on Monday. This is 94.9 KUOW.
The U.S. jobless rate has dropped to 7.7%. That's a four-year low. That and more of today's news in a moment. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the School of Teaching ESL in cooperation with Seattle Pacific University, presenting an information session on training options to teach English as a second language in the U.S. or overseas at 7 p.m. Wednesday, March 20th in North Seattle. Details and registration at schoolofTESL.com.
This Week in This American Life, why do anything new? Let's face it, we love routine. We want things to stay the same. Reruns are more comforting than regular TV.
Last night, I was watching TV, and I couldn't find a rerun anywhere, and I was, like, panicking and flipping. Oh, there was a rerun, though. It was, like, a rerun of, like, The Nanny was on, and I don't have any relationship with it, so I was, like, stuck.
I've stuck in reruns this week.
Tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.